Just to let you know how things are going to work today, in a minute I'm going to hand over to Chris Kent from the RBA to give an update on Reserve Bank operations. Obviously, there are a lot of those at the moment, and so we're going to hear about the plumbing and what's been going on under the hood. There's then an opportunity to ask Chris questions. I will hand over to Chris. We're delighted to have you here, Chris. Thanks for joining us in this first Kangan News Live video webinar. I'm really looking forward to what you have to say. So thanks very much, Chris.
Well, thanks, Lawrence, and thank you very much for your kind introduction and indeed for Kangan News for hosting this event. As Lawrence said, I'm going to talk about some of the plumbing about our operations that we've been pursuing of late. But just let me start by saying that in the early stages of the pandemic, there was extreme uncertainty about how much economic activity would decline and how long the economic disruption would last. It was also uncertain how much support would be provided by monetary and fiscal authorities. And so as the virus spread around the world through early March, extreme uncertainty and the prospect of a sizable decline in economic activity, all of that was reflected in financial markets globally. And as you can see here in this chart, in particular, there was a sharp rise in the volatility of asset prices. There was also a decline in the prices of risky assets and before too long, dislocation in quite a number of key financial markets. Most notable, of course, were the problems affecting government bond markets, which are critical to the pricing and operation of financial markets more broadly. And Australia was no exception. So these conditions underpinned a general rush for liquidity, including by banks and other financial institutions. More generally, investors in a wide range of financial markets also sought to shore up their liquidity and reduce their exposures to riskier positions. And in reaction to this increase in the demand for liquidity around the world, central banks increased the supply of liquidity as part of a broader policy response to support their economies. They provided that liquidity initially by scaling up their open market operations. Central banks also bought government bonds in secondary markets, and they did this with a view to restoring more normal functioning in those markets. But it also had the effect of providing additional liquidity to those selling bonds. Furthermore, a number of central banks started new facilities or extended existing ones to provide longer-term funding to banks at favourable rates. So all of that led to a sharp increase in central bank balance sheets shown here for a number of central banks, us included. Central banks that had room also cut policy rates. In many cases, that was accompanied by forward guidance that policy rates would remain low for some time. Some pursued quantitative easing or QE, whereby they committed to buying particular quantities of government bonds over and above what was required to restore market functioning. Rather than announcing a quantity target, the Reserve Bank opted instead for a yield target, whereby we stand ready to buy Australian government securities so that the yield at the three-year mark stays around 25 basis points. I thought it'd be helpful to be clear here, though, that our three-year yield target applies to the bond with residual maturity closest to 3 years, as opposed to something like the futures basket. And that means that the focus of our target will shift from the April 2023 bond to the April 2024 bond later this year. Now, what follows, I'm going to focus much of my attention on the details of our operations that affected liquidity, market function, and term funding. But I'll also finish up by considering the implications of these various developments for conditions in the markets for fixed income securities. Turning to liquidity. In response to the sharp rise in the demand for liquidity from the banks in early March, the Reserve Bank began to increase the supply of liquidity to the banking system via a normal daily open market operations. Now, for a time, this was done by dealing more liquidity than our announced intentions. And in this graph, there's a lot here, but what I just said can be seen by the orange filled bars exceeding the blue dealing intentions line in that period. And then by mid-March, this increase in the amount dealt had become very substantial, and we began offering also longer terms on a regular basis. By the latter part of March, liquidity in the banking system, as measured by banks' exchange settlement balances held at the Reserve Bank, they rose even further. And this was the result of the Reserve Bank's, purchases of government bonds in secondary markets to help achieve the yield target on three-year AGS, as well as to improve the functioning of government bond markets. By the early part of April, take-up of the term funding facility, also part of our policy package, that was adding further to banks' ES balances. And by mid-April, there were signs that the increased supply of ES balances had met the surge in demand for liquidity in the banking system. And this was evident in the sustained drop in the amounts dealt at our morning auctions. Financial conditions more broadly had also become more settled. So as this chart shows that we had switched our approach in our open market operations over this period. But previously, we'd targeted a particular level of ES balances, and we used the price or the repo rate to determine which counterparty bids were filled and which were unfilled. But lately, we've seen what we've been doing is meeting the demand of banks that presented auctions at a steady repo rate. Given the high level of ES balances supplied by the Reserve Bank, it's not surprising that the cash rate fell below 25 basis points, as you can see here. Since the latter part of April, it's generally been either 13 or 14 basis points. 13's been more common. Daily volumes of cash transactions between banks have declined, since many banks don't need to borrow overnight from one another, given the relatively large balances that they each have in their own ES accounts. Indeed, on some days, there's been insufficient volumes to calculate the cash rate based on market transactions. And on those days, we've instead used expert judgment as set out in our fallback procedures to determine the published cash rate. These fallback procedures ensure that we can continue to publish the cash rate. Typically, we've used the last published rate based on sufficient market transactions, but there has been just one occasion when we published another rate that we judged to have better reflected recent market conditions. One thing we're continuing to do as usual during our regular operations is to buy back AGS that are near to maturity. This is done in order to reduce very large swings in the supply of ES balances that would otherwise occur on those days when a large bond line matures. These buyback operations occur either via OMOs or bilaterally. They're conducted separately from those purchases at auctions for the purpose of hitting either the target for three-year AGS yield or to improve market function. The low level of the cash rate and the high level of liquidity provided by the bank have also contributed to low rates in other money market instruments, such as bank bills. For some time now, 3-month and 6-month bank bills have been trading around market expectations of the future cash rate. So the actions of the Reserve Bank have contributed to historically low funding costs for banks, as you can see here. Also, banks have benefited from an influx of low-cost deposits. Some of that has come from businesses that tapped their lines of credit, but then left those funds on deposit. There are a number of other reasons for the increase in bank deposits. This includes increased spending by the Australian government, which leads to funds being paid out from the government's account at the Reserve Bank to customers of commercial banks. The purchase of government bonds by the Reserve Bank from non-banks has had the same effect. But let me turn now to market function. A number of key financial markets have became dysfunctional through early March, including the critical markets for AGS, as well as the semi-government securities or semis. This was recently discussed at some length by the Deputy Governor, Guy DeBell, so I'm just going to provide a short summary of the key points, and then I'm going to turn a bit more to the mechanics of those operations. The substantial fall in risky asset prices in early March underpinned a sharp increase in financial market volatility more broadly. This meant that a range of investors needed to sell assets to reduce their leverage or to cover margin calls and also perhaps to meet redemptions. Many investors sold government bonds, and it didn't take long before the dealers were unable to absorb more of that one-sided flow, including because of their own internal risk limits. Hence, we face the very and extremely unusual situation whereby prices of risky and risk-free assets were both falling. The fact that markets were not functioning well was apparent in a range of other metrics, including the sharp rise in bid offer spreads for AGS and semis, a sharp fall in the ability to trade in bond futures without moving the price, and the breakdown of various no arbitrage relationships, including between bond futures and the underlying bonds that they reference. So you can see here the bid offer spreads jumping for both AGS and semis in that early to mid part of March. Given that the underlying cause of the market dysfunction was an urgent need to sell bonds and bond holdings and raise cash, the Reserve Bank decided to step in and provide the market with some liquidity. And we did this by offering to buy bank government bonds at auctions. For each auction, we announced the amount we'd purchase, which particular bond lines we'd be willing to buy, and then we let counterparties bid to sell those bonds to us. Now, the bonds we actually bought within that suite depended on the bids at auction, whereby what we did was purchase those, of course, at the lowest possible price or the highest yield. The choice of which bonds we offered to buy in the first place and the overall amount, that was informed by a number of sources, including liaison with market participants, the AOFM, and the State and Territory Government Borrowing Authority. We also assessed the extent of dysfunction based on some of the indicators I mentioned earlier, including which bonds appeared most mispriced. But the auction results themselves were also informative for subsequent auctions. So, for example, at some auctions we received a lot of offers to sell bonds, and those bonds were clearly priced to sell, that is, they were offered at yields above mid-market. So that was a good indication that there was an excess stock of bonds in that segment of the market clogging up the dealers' balance sheets. In such cases, we concluded that further auctions in that part of the yield curve within quick time were warranted. On the other hand, if an auction didn't receive that many offers or the pricing we received was relatively unattractive, well, that indicated that there was no large supply or demand supply-demand imbalance, and therefore no pressing need for us to conduct further auctions in that part of the curve. The bank's purchases have had the intended effect. As we purchased bonds, the imbalance of supply and demand was redressed, and this was evident in a decline over time in the volume of attractively priced offers to sell bonds to us. It was also evident in other measures, including the bid offer spreads shown here, as well as mispricing along the yield curve and the ability to trade futures without moving the price. These all improved to be close to pre-crisis levels. Now, I think it's true to say, though, that the general improvement in financial sentiment, aided by a range of other policies, both monetary and fiscal, is also likely to have played a role. In any case, since April, we've scaled back bond purchases significantly, and we've not needed to purchase any bonds for some time. We do stand ready, though, to buy bonds if bond market conditions deteriorate significantly, or indeed if it's needed to achieve the target of around 25 basis points for the three-year AGS yield. Now, another initiative from the bank was the term funding facility to lower borrowing costs and support lending, particularly to businesses. The TFF does this by providing a guaranteed source of funding to ADIs for 3 years at the low cost of 25 basis points, with an incentive to increase lending to businesses, especially SMEs. Funds provided under the TFF are secured against collateral, as is the case with all our facilities. So the TFF provided banks with the option of an initial allowance of around 90 billion, but this has since grown to around 150 billion with the additional allowances that have been granted to individual banks because they've increased their lending to businesses since the facility began in April. Take-up of the TFF is currently around 26 billion, and that's about 17% of the total currently on offer. There are a few reasons why banks have not taken up more of this funding at this stage in the program. One is simply that many banks have accessed even cheaper funding from other sources in recent months, albeit at shorter tenors than 3 years. In particular, banks have been able to issue bank bills at rates below 25 basis points. Similarly, bank deposits have grown and an increasing share of those have been paying rates below 25 basis points. Also, the TFF provides funding for 3 years from the date of the drawdown. So the longer that a bank waits to draw on the funds that it can take out, and later they'll have to repay the money. And with no pressing funding need right now, the ample alternative short-term funding at low cost, delaying the drawdown is a pretty useful option for them. Now, having said that, the calculus underpinning the decision of some banks to delay drawing on their initial TFF allocations, that's going to change closer to the deadline of 30th September. But at that time, it's going to make sense for banks to compare the very certain 25 basis point cost of the TFF with the uncertain cost of other sources of funding over the next 3 years, including bonds that would mature over that period. And as I'll show later, and you've seen the chart before, they're at a higher cost than the TFF. So our expectation and our liaison with the bank suggests that take-up of the TFF as we get closer to the end of September. And despite only part of the funding being drawn down to date, I think it's worth noting that the TFF, combined with our other policy measures, has already had a significant impact. On the funding side, the ability to draw on the TFF means the banks can be selective in how they raise their money, and this has contributed to overall bank funding costs falling by around 60 basis points since February. And on the lending side, we've seen interest rates on new fixed rate mortgages fall by around 65 basis points since that time, and rates on SME loans fall by around 60 basis points. So now I want to turn to my attention to what all of these developments imply for private sector fixed income markets. Like government bond markets, private sector income markets also became dysfunctional in March. These markets were significantly disrupted for a time as concerns and uncertainty about the economic and financial effects of the pandemic rose sharply. Issuers typically try to avoid going to market with new bonds at such times, given the very high premiums that are typically demanded by investors, particularly if the issuers have the option of waiting because they're already well funded or they have other funding options. However, with the aid of monetary and fiscal policies, it didn't take too long for financial conditions to settle and fixed income markets to reopen. Issuance, though, has varied quite considerably across different types of issuers since that time. So if we turn to the next chart, the major banks have let their existing bonds mature without replacement. So their issuance has declined in net terms, as you can see on the left panel here. And they've not issued any residential mortgage-backed securities either. Now, this is not surprising given the number of forces at work, some of which I've talked about already. First, we've got credit growth, which is likely to remain low or even decline. And so their funding needs will remain modest for a time. Second, they'd issued quite a lot of bonds prior to the pandemic and have subsequently found themselves flush with these other sources of funding that I've talked about, including low-cost deposits. And while these sources don't have the same maturity profile as longer bonds, they lessen the need for term issuance. And third, they've got the option of accessing funds from the TFF at a cost of just 25 basis points, while the cost of a newly issued bond of similar maturity is around 30 to 60 basis points. We look on the right-hand panel, other smaller banks, well, they have issued bonds over recent months. In part, this reflects the fact that they haven't benefited to the same extent as the major banks from an influx of deposits. But in any case, their issuance is roughly offsetting maturity, so in net terms, issuance isn't increasing, as you can see here. Similarly, mortgage originators, they've resumed issuance of RMBS over the past few months, following a pause in April. Now, the AOFM has supported this by purchasing RMBS directly at issuance and in the secondary market. Spreads at issuance are a little higher, as you can see in the next chart, than they were at the start of the year, but they don't stand out when taking a slightly longer term perspective. And it's worth noting here, so these are spreads to BBSW, but yields are at very low levels because BBSW rates are at very low levels. Over the year to date, non-financial corporations, if we move to the next chart, you can see they've been issuing bonds to about the same extent as they have in recent years. After a period when markets were disrupted during the height of the market stresses in March, these firms have been able to issue bonds in good qualities and at relatively favourable yields, and that's all very welcome. The relatively low level of yields reflects the historically low level of risk-free rates, with a three-year ADS yield consistent with the board's target of around 25 basis points. Also, the spreads on corporate bonds are relatively low. Spreads in secondary markets rose earlier in the year in response to fears about the health of the business sector, but they've eased somewhat since then, aided by the significant policy support. Finally, many large firms have also tapped their credit lines at banks in March and April, providing a significant boost to business credit. Now, part of that appears to have been precautionary. We know that because firms have since repaid some of their revolving credit facilities more recently. Another source of funding has been the very substantial issuance of equity in recent months by a wide range of listed firms. And those companies raising equity have cited the desire to strengthen their balance sheets and in some cases to pursue opportunity for growth. So let me just draw all this together by way of conclusion. In response to the severe impact of the pandemic on economic activity and financial markets, the Australian authorities have provided unprecedented support, including via fiscal, monetary, and prudential policy. Monetary policy has been focused on supporting the economy by keeping the cost of borrowing low and helping to maintain the supply of credit to households. To help achieve these ends, the Reserve Bank has undertaken a number of significant operations. First, it responded to the sharp rise in demand for liquidity by the banking system by scaling up its daily open market operations. It met the demand for liquidity from banks, providing that at longer terms against high quality collateral. Second, the bank provided much needed liquidity in a different manner by purchasing government bonds outright at a time when there were plenty of sellers and very few buyers in those critical markets. And third, we provided the option of low cost funding to banks by rolling out the term funding facility. Now, while we refer to this as funding, it is liquidity provision by another name. The banks obtained cash for 3-year terms by posting collateral. So even though these operations are novel in some respects, in many ways they can be thought of as representing really the bread and butter of central banking, providing liquidity to meet demand at a time of considerable need, thereby acting to stabilise crucial markets. From my perspective, these operations have worked well. Along with other monetary, fiscal, prudential and health policies, they've contributed to a noticeable improvement in market sentiment and accommodative financial conditions. Among other things, we clearly see the effect of that in the ability of firms to gain access to a wide range of funding at low rates, and that includes in fixed income markets. So Lawrence, I'll hand back to you and I look forward to answering your questions as best I can.
Thanks very much, Chris. Just a reminder to participants to use the Q&A function that you'll see at the bottom of your screen if you're on the Zoom video for to send in questions. That's how we'll be taking them today. And Chris, if you could stay as close to your mic as you can, just you did a couple of times. He's got slightly indistinct there, but it's much appreciated. No problem at all. It was a very, very minor issue. First question I've got here is around the long end, Chris, the suggestion's been made that the RBA is effectively leaning on the balance sheets of other global central banks to keep the long end in check by targeting specifically 3-year. I remember that was the closest we had to a topic of controversy when the initial measures were announced, that it was purely 3-year yield control. The question is, does this matter? And what's your view on the long end more generally and a somewhat steeper curve?
I think I'd answer that by saying that the reason we're focused on 3 years is for as the target is it complements other elements of the package, and it's also worth remembering that it's a pretty important part of the curve for funding for banks. That's true all the way from the short end out to about 3 years or so. It also appears, at least statistically, to have a pretty strong relationship, that short end of the curve, with the exchange rate. So for all those reasons, it's a useful target for in terms of the transmission of monetary policy. There's certainly less funding, at least for the private sector, at the 10-year point than is true of other economies, such as the US, to which we're often compared. Now, in terms of their other central bank policies, which are focused at their long end of their curves, to the extent that that helps stabilise financial conditions globally, then that's a good thing. Maybe that has had some effect on our exchange rate, causing it to appreciate more than otherwise. But again, the interest rate differential of us versus major economies out to about 3 years seems to be the more important determinant.
Thanks, Chris. A question that's come in from the audience indeed came in last week, so someone who's very keen, feel we should definitely get this one asked. One component of balance sheet liabilities is notes on issue. Growth in 1920 was an extraordinary 9.5 billion, following more modest rises of 4.3 and 1.9 billion in the two previous years. Can you share with us any insights on the reasons or demographics of this recent demand?
I don't have a lot of insights. It would seem strange on the surface. I think the one thing we know is it's not being used for transactions for obvious purposes. People are actually trying to avoid using hard currency to avoid the spread of the virus as much as they can. And that's been encouraged, of course, also by the major retailers asking for customers, if they can, to pay electronically. So it's not for transaction purposes, so one only has to assume it's for some people feeling like they need a store of value. But much more than that, I can't add.
Sure, thanks, thanks, Chris. Couple of questions on deposits. On a high level, you mentioned in your presentation, obviously, and I think most people will be aware that major bank, in particular, deposit inflows have been very large. Do you expect those to unwind as we move on through the crisis? I mean, they're obviously caused in one form or another by the crisis. So are you sort of working on the principle that that's a temporary phenomenon?
Not really. I mean, some of that might be a bit temporary. A bit hard to know. I think there are some different forces operating in different directions. Those who are keen students of my earlier speeches, when I've got a speech on money is born of credit, and that's a point I make in the speech, that some of the larger businesses tapped their credit lines with banks and then left the funds that they took out with the same banks on deposit. So that pushed up deposits and money supply, money growth. But now it seems that many of them are not using those funds and they're paying back because the credit facilities are relatively expensive and they don't need the funding right now. So that's going to go the other way. The other thing that's a bit tricky here is, say, the state governments, when they issue, they leave their funds on deposits. So essentially the banks are providing, to the extent that banks are providing the semis, with some funding, that tends to increase the money supply. So that's going to be ongoing. But of course, the other one is when we've purchased bonds from the non-banking sector, that puts money in the accounts of the non-banking sector. So all of these sort of factors are at work. It's a bit hard to know where it's going to go. One imagines that a key, the long-term source of growth comes from credit. And that's not likely to be strong in the coming period.
Okay, thanks, Chris. A more specific question on deposits that's coming from the audience. Is the bank aware that non-major banks have effectively closed their doors to deposits from organisations like councils, universities and corporations? If so, is any consideration being given to this, perhaps unintended consequence of the TFF and the resultant increase in concentration of deposits with the major banks?
I'm not across the specific details of that. What we did know early on was quite a large inflow of deposits was coming from superannuation funds. They were trying to liquidate some of their portfolios just to get ready for the demand for early withdrawals that was being made available to some people. So they were wanting to hold a lot of liquidity, and they tended to move some of that money away from some of the smaller banks to the larger banks. I think some of that's unwinding now, that process. I don't know that the smaller banks I haven't heard that they're turning away deposits. It may be that they're just not willing to offer the same rates, but that's true of deposits across the banking system, including the majors.
Okay, thanks, Chris. A question from one of our panelists, actually. In the short end, does the combination of low yield and lack of volatility give you cause for concern around the attractiveness or viability of ACGB at the front end of the curve? Over a sustained period of time, do you think this means the RBA will ultimately have to restart purchases?
Well, look, I think what our focus is just on keeping the three-year yield at around 25 basis points. It has been fairly close to that for most of the time that this has been in place. We notice it's been rising a little bit late, but it does move around from day to day, week to week. That's something we're watching closely, and we said if we need to, if it was to move too far away from 25, then we would stand ready to buy more. So I don't know if that quite really directly answers their question, but the main thing we're focused on is very much on that three-year target in terms of that that side of our business, our package.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Moving on the term funding facility, you mentioned in your presentation the impact that you've seen on the cost of credit provision in the wider economy. The question is, how would you assess the efficacy of the TFF as a means of stimulating credit supply? So I guess I have to ask specifically in the context of volume. I have certainly seen it myself raised in some research notes that in economic conditions of the kind we've got, there isn't a great deal of desire from SMEs to invest for growth. So I guess the question is, has it worked on a scale front?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's important to recognise the difference between credit supply and credit demand, which I think the question you posed does. On the supply side, it certainly has helped to reduce the cost of funding both directly and indirectly. So that's kind of a supply response there for you. In terms of encouraging an increase in credit, because it is cheap funding and there is this incentive where you get more dollars of cheap funding, an extra dollar for every dollar of credit to a large business, and an extra $5 for every dollar of credit that goes out the door from a bank to an SME. I think it is encouraging banks to lend. We've already seen that in play. There is an extra allocation available that reflects growth of business credit for a range of banks. So that's why the sort of initial allotment that was around that $90 billion is now up to $150 billion. Much of that has been because of credit going out the door to larger businesses. But banks that have increased lending to small businesses have got an extra allocation from that. But you're right, the growth of overall credit will depend very much on demand as well. And
sure. Thanks, Chris. A question that's coming from the audience. I guess you might have been expecting this one, probably be dealt with reasonably quickly. If inflation turns into deflation, can negative interest rate policy be an option to take?
Well, I don't have a lot of extra to add to what the governor said recently on this. Our sense is it's not helpful, not going to be helpful in the current circumstances. It's also not clear just how helpful it's been elsewhere, even in economies where it has been used. One thing I'd mention in that regard is just that where it has been moved into negative territory, central banks that still have further room to move potentially into further into negative territory haven't really pursued that option. Of course, one of the problems is it impinges on banks' profitability and therefore their willingness to lend, so that's not helpful for macroeconomic conditions. And I would also just finish on this by saying, look, interest rates at the moment are really not a constraint on the capacity or willingness for people to borrow. Just aggregate demand is weak and companies are facing economic uncertainty. So I think that's what's weighing on demand for credit more so than the price of it.
Sure. Thanks, Chris. Look, a related question is being asked about further intervention, by which specifically is meant new measures as opposed to a resumption or stepping up of, for instance, government bond purchases. Should we assume that the bar is very high to further measures being put in place by the RBA?
Well, I think the governor provided a sense of that when he spoke last week by noting that many of the other things that are new measures are not without costs. And that's not to say they would never be pursued, but they have these costs, and you'd have to think very carefully about the circumstances you're in for each and every one of them. So I think it's sort of broadly true that in the current circumstances we face, they're not under consideration, but that could change if things get decidedly worse.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chris. Moving on, another audience question here. How do you view the trade-offs of running a large balance sheet? And is there a limit to how large you would let the ES balances grow?
Well, at the moment, really, the size of the ES balances are partly determined just by the bank's demand, because as I suggested in the speech, when they come to our open market operations, we're providing them what they demand. That's settled right down, so it does seem we've satiated the demand for now. There are other forces at work, including through our package, that will probably push ES balances higher, and the term funding facility is very much one of those. So there's room for further growth in our balance sheet. I don't see that as being problematic. What we're really trying to do is pursue these programs first and foremost to keep funding costs low, to promote the supply of credit to the economy. So if that means our balance sheet has to grow a bit, then so be it, and that's fine and not a problem.
Okay, speaking of things that the Reserve Bank may be relatively relaxed on, audience question says the bank seems relaxed on the level of the currency. Is that due in part to it being less important at the moment, given the situation with international education and tourism?
Well, certainly those mechanisms mean that depreciation won't be stimulatory through trade in services, one way or the other. But it is still an important transmission of monetary policy. But our assessment at the moment is it's not that far from sort of its fundamentals, which are, of course, commodity prices and the interest rate differential. And it's also about the relative performance of our economy versus economies offshore. Our assessment is not that far from fundamentals, and on that basis we wouldn't be overly concerned. But the governor's talked at some length for many years, even well before the pandemic, that many countries in the circumstance where they have spare capacity and would like to see inflation move higher, would like to be able to dial up a lower exchange rate. But not everyone can have that. But at the moment, our assessment is it's around fundamental levels.
Sure. Okay. We've already had a question about the market based consequences of an anchored 3-year yield. Here's another one. What's your view on the outlook for the 3-year futures market, given we're getting a 5-year contract later this year, and that the 3-year yield and volatility seems pretty anchored?
I don't have a particular view on that I can offer and provide any insight on. So I'll pass on that. If that's all right, Lawrence.
No problem at all. On to something that you didn't directly address in the presentation, but has been talked about in market circles somewhat. One of the other measures that I guess maybe wasn't mentioned because most people have suggested it'll have a relatively marginal impact is corporate repo eligibility. Mm. The view seems to be it should be a modest positive for the local corporate bond market over the sort of medium to longer term, but probably no more than that. Is that sort of what you were hoping for? Was that the plan? And just while we're on the topic, a specific question about that: would offshore banks issuing in Aussie dollars, as in non-ADIs, qualify as for repo as under a corporate designation?
You've got me there. I'd have to look it up. It's quite clear on our site, but let me not make up the answer without looking at that or waste everyone's time by finding it. I think I'll take just the first part of the question to say, look, we acknowledge that it was going to be a helpful change. The evidence I've seen isn't conclusive, but I think you've already seen, at least at the time we made the announcement, you saw a small improvement in yields in terms of the issuers, for the issuers of the paper that would potentially qualify. So that's a small benefit because it enhances the liquidity of those bonds. It means it's a bit cheaper for them to issue them. So that's good again for the funding cost, but it is a pretty marginal thing, and I wouldn't overstress that it's going to have a significant effect, just a marginal and helpful effect in the right direction.
Okay, probably just time for one, maybe two more. Another technical one. You mentioned in your presentation the cash rate calculation during the sort of the most stressed period. What about the RBA view on BBSW calculation? Was that as functional as could be expected? Did the stress period make any change of view on BBSW?
Not really. We've seen, it's a bit hard to know exactly why. We saw some periods where the volumes traded at the window when the rates are set sort of dropped down for a time, but they've come back up again. The volume of issuance has sort of stayed roughly where it's been for some time. There's still very good reasons for the banks to continue to issue BBSW. So it should endure as a useful benchmark. But it's got its own procedures in place when volumes take a move lower for a time. And I think that things are essentially fine for that market. There's no longer term impact, I think, of recent events on the viability of that as a benchmark.
Thanks, Chris. I think we might leave it there. We're on time, and we've covered quite a lot of ground. And I certainly really appreciate, as I'm sure the audience does, you taking a lot of questions that were off-piste, and we jumped around a lot. So thanks for being willing to engage with all of them. This is normally where I'd ask for a round of applause, but you probably have to imagine that, I'm afraid, Chris. I'm sure it's happening in home offices across the nation as we speak, but thank you very much, Chris.
Thank you for organizing the event, and thanks all for listening. Cheers, and for your
not questions. At all. Thank you, Chris.